after today and to some extent next week than we will throughout the semester. I think, as you heard by all the interesting experiences we have around this table, it would be another disservice for me to sit and hear myself talk, which I have a tendency to do, for 2 hours straight every week. So I definitely hope that this will be, as the room would facilitate to an extent, a conversation, a series of dialogues, a series of debates and ideas that we'll all be engaged participants in, that I'll facilitate and lead us along some of the points that I think are most pertinent to where we are and where we're trying to go. But I certainly hope that this isn't a one-way, Fidel Castro around the clock kind of manifesto from me every Thursday afternoon. So I think all of us can work together, that I will try to talk less once we're up and running, and hope that on your end we'll be ready to engage and think through these really interesting sets of topics, which will let us segue seamlessly to talking about syllabus. So that's that usual boilerplate language, which about what the course is, and we'll certainly say more about it. There's my info. So my office is over on the other side of the suite, or just around the corner from, if you're going from Nora or Jones's office. If these names don't mean anything to you, just find a face over there and ask them to point you towards me, and that's fine. But if you know who these folks are, if you're going from Nora's office and you pass Autumn's, I'm a couple doors down, back where those sofas and lounges are currently. My little cubbyhole office is over there. So I'm usually around, but if you do think you'll be stopping by, drop me an email just so I know that I'm here if you do want to talk. Otherwise, I may not be, and then I think doing things by appointment tends to work better than the office hours, which tends to wind up as 3 hours of solitude a week for me. So I'd much rather find a time where we can sit and chat than maybe be on call. So here again, the time 6:30 is the actual finish time, despite what we publicize. Grading and assignments I'll come back to in the end. I want to work backwards from topics, because that's more interesting and sort of feeds into what we'll be putting together individually and collectively throughout the semester. So skip to page 4. So there is one required book, as you noted in the email. I see some of you have it. It's this one. And I will put in a plug for the Penn Book Center. I looked at the price. The price there is $1 more than the price that you can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble right now. So assuming you have one of those things where you have to pay for shipping, unless you've paid for the fancy free shipping thing, you will save money getting it at the Penn Book Center, and you will contribute to all those good things about helping independent bookstores. The Penn Book Center stays in business basically on the course sales, and then the rest of the year they lose money selling actual books. So if we can keep that in business and save a few dollars, feel free to buy it there, where they are in stock and available for your purchase. Again, we don't need it until next week, so you probably still have time if you really just have someone who works for Borders and you want to crumble those remaining small independent booksellers. That's your choice. That's a different ethics course. But this is a good book, and we were using I wanted to use so many different papers from it that it was felt kind of unethical to just scan and put these on Blackboard. So I thought, in deference to the editors who put together these series of papers, which do what we will be trying to do throughout the semester, of thinking about what public health is, why does it matter, how should programs be designed and implemented. It's not explicitly a public health ethics book, but as you'll see these names, it's a fairly small community of scholars who are active in the public health ethics discourse, and many of them are in this volume. So it's useful. We'll be sprinkling in a chapter here and there throughout the weeks. So that's the one thing you have to buy. Everything else, as you've seen perhaps if you've checked out the Blackboard site, is scanned, waiting for you throughout the semester on Blackboard. And I hope you're still here, so that's a good thing. Hopefully the syllabus didn't overwhelm you with it. It looks far more onerous than I think you will find it, both in terms of quantity of pieces and their length. If you look for any given week, many of these items are 2, 3, 4 page kinds of items, New England Journal of Medicine commentaries, a short item in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. There's a lot of short items here, but they've been chosen for each has been chosen for a reason to fulfill my sort of own idiosyncratic way of thinking about these issues, which will help us for any given topic get a little bit of background as far as historical context, not, you know, 17th century, you know, sanitary reformers history, but contemporary history about, for example, when we do the Tobacco Week, Alan Brandt, the Harvard historian of medicine's incredible book that he got on The Daily Show for, about the history of tobacco marketing and promotion in the last 50 or 60 years, and that really important story about the work of the tobacco manufacturers, the evidence they had, the evidence they refused to publicize, some of the great and important legal cases that led to important policy decisions that we are now seeing and implementing today. So in those cases, there are items in there that are historical with a sort of 1950s forward focus. There are pieces that are straight articles by ethicists, by public health ethicists, by other people who are interested in explicitly thinking about ethics and values. There are some pieces that are heavy on scientific or medical facts. We need to have interesting discussions about ethics and values. We need to understand what the current state of these topics are. So if we're thinking about soda taxes and obesity, well, we need to understand how these policies have been implemented, what the public health arguments for and against them, before we then figure out where the ethical route lies. So you'll have some of those, you'll have some policy pieces. So it's a combination that I think together help us get for each week, after these first couple sort of introductory weeks, a nice comprehensive set of tools to think with about each topic. It is absolutely the case that for every one of these weeks, we could do a full course on those topics. And in some cases, we have. Dr. Kaplan, several years ago, did a course just on vaccines. My colleague Lance Whaler is doing a course on Mondays just on HIV/AIDS and bioethics. And you could certainly do courses on bioethics and tobacco. Eric Feldman in the law school has an incredible amount of expertise. So our goal here is the sweet spot between breadth and depth, to use these case studies as ways to think about how broad the reach and importance of public health is, but to avoid sort of the superficiality that could come from just sort of dropping in, reading one piece about something, and moving on from there. So this week and next will help us understand a little bit about what public health ethics is as a field. There is a small field. It's clustered in a few universities. The ethics section of the American Public Health Association usually sits in a room around this size when we get there. And if you've been to APHA in the past, there's 10, 11, 12,000 attendees overall, but the ethics group is small, and we'll see that from just the repetition of scholars who have made their way onto the syllabus. So we'll talk a little bit about what public health ethics is as a community, its relationship to bioethics, and some frameworks that have been developed, that's both this week and next, to sort of think about generalizable ways about how to proceed in thinking about ethical issues in the design of public health programs. So these will be the tools, as I note there, that if you haven't had a chance to read the four or five pieces for today, it's well worth your time to do them prior to next week, because these two sets of readings will give us some of the language, some of the concepts, some of the principles that when we move into a case study tour, which is the bulk of the semester, we're going to come back to a lot of these ideas that have been raised in these first 10 or so readings. So that's this week and next. Along the way, we'll certainly provide a little, very skeletal discussion about where public health is today and how it got there, just so we have that discourse for those of us in the room who haven't spent a great deal of time thinking about the history or contemporary state of public health, which is an important one unto itself that we'll at least mention and fill in the gaps as we go along. So that'll be this week and next. In June, that first week there, we're going to do a couple things that are related. We're going to think about some of the institutions that are responsible for shaping public health policy. You know, I deliberately picked things here that would broaden our appreciation of what public health is beyond investigating epidemics, beyond collecting data. We're going to certainly talk about those things, but there's been a push, for example, in the case of the FDA to define itself not as a consumer protection agency, which is one of the ways in which the FDA operated for decades, but to view itself explicitly as a public health agency, as Peggy Hamburg, the current director, wrote in a New England Journal editorial. And that's important. It's important to think about the role of the regulation of drugs, the testing of safety and efficacy of medications, the post-licensure surveillance, to think about those things as public health activities in beyond their general sort of consumer protection roots. So I pick things there that also would encourage us to think about the role of government in intervening or interacting with medical treatment decisions, medical care, through the use of pharmaceuticals. So there's a handful of readings about that in particular. And then there's a handful of classics about important cases in public health-focused research, particularly research involving sexually transmitted diseases. And a more recent example at Johns Hopkins in the Kennedy Krieger Institute lead paint study. Some of these will be familiar to veterans of our master's program, but they're worth a fresh look, a short look, or revisiting if they're new to you, to think about ways in which the challenges of conducting research that's not focused on individual clinical interventions, but is are interested in understanding disease trends, disease rates, and broad population-based observations and strategies related to preserving public health. That'll include a section of the Guatemala report and the paper that brought it about, because that was used by the request of the president as a way to think about contemporary questions of international human subject research. Our focus will be largely in the U.S. throughout the semester, but we will have time to transition into international concerns, which are incredibly important and complex, but hard to do justice to all of them in our limited time together. So we'll think about these historical analogs that shape contemporary discussions about research in these areas in that time on the 7th. The next week we transition to, again, to related topics. I think if there hadn't been a dedicated HIV, AIDS, and bioethics course this summer, AIDS would have certainly gotten its own week, and I think it had in earlier drafts, but again, just to make the schedule fit and knowing the other opportunities that were here, I combined some important pieces about ethics and the AIDS epidemic, past and present, with broader questions that certainly were related to it about public health surveillance, about mandatory notification of disease states to usually to state public health departments, which was an early vocal controversy with HIV/AIDS patients and remains debated, as it does for other name-based and other types of disease reporting for other infectious diseases, particularly in these questions about individual privacy and the public health value of these kinds of information are things we'll be exploring in that week, among other topics. Week after that is my second love. I almost said my true love, but my wife would not be thrilled at all about that. We'll talk about some of the issues regarding the regulation and promotion of vaccines, with a little bit of context, talking about mandatory vaccination policies, some of the unique issues regarding human papillomavirus vaccines, and some of these interesting questions about risk-benefit trade-offs when we are developing and promoting vaccines. You know, it's a challenging topic to talk about. And this is going to be true throughout the course, to think about mass interventions like vaccines that have great benefits but also have risks, and to try and communicate how those thresholds exist for when some degree of risk is either too severe or too frequent such that it outweighs its benefits, to try and talk about that to the public without it becoming some sort of utilitarian, we're willing to sacrifice the few for the good of the many, is a huge challenge for public health communication and a huge challenge for decision making. And that shows up with vaccines when there are, before you even get to the alleged risks in that entire controversy, even for the limited rare risks that we know are associated with some vaccines, very rare, very uncommon, to explain why, still on balance, it's an important and valuable intervention. So we'll talk about the risk decision-making, the risk communication, and some of the strategies used to finance and promote vaccines and how that can become ethically fraught, particularly in the case of mandates. Week after that, sort of move down this series of infectious-type disease issues and think about public health emergencies, pandemics, bioterror, things where there has been tremendous amount of attention, particularly in the ethical implication questions as related to the 2001 anthrax attacks and their aftermath, related to pandemic influenza, related to the guy on the plane, which we'll talk about, the Andrew Speaker, who had what was thought to have a very infectious, difficult to treat version of tuberculosis, who was then isolated by government order. So we'll think about public health powers in these contexts of public health emergencies, both the role of planning, the role of response, questions about allocation of scarce resources like vaccines and other things, thinking about the role of isolation and quarantine powers. Just very recently, there was this interesting story, a different version of TB. Did I bring it with me? This gentleman who was arrested in jailed, I think, in San Francisco for failing to comply with his directly observed therapy regimen. I'm seeing some nods here. People have seen it for tuberculosis. It's one of those ways to ensure compliance with drug regimens is to make people to come and watch them take the antibiotic regimen. And this gentleman wasn't, and they tracked him down in accordance with public health procedures and laws, and locked him up pending disposition of his case. So we'll talk about that and those interesting questions about this, the role of public health authorities in these circumstances. That's going to be our 3-week block of infectious disease issues. Then we'll transition after the 4th of July, literally after the 4th of July, to non-infectious disease, chronic disease prevention, which in the second half of the 20th century became a increasingly significant focus of public health resources. And we're seeing this particularly in the case of obesity, in the case of soda taxes, in the case of figuring out ways to address our nation's obesity problem and its consequences with, as far as diabetes and mortality, particularly among children. So we'll, that first week there, we'll look at the work from Kelly Brownell at Yale, who's really probably the leading scholar on these questions about food and public health, and some of the policy suggestions that have been brought forward from things that are probably less contentious, like posting calorie counts on menu boards at restaurants, which have been shown to have significant effects, to questions like soda taxes and even more coercive, some would say, measures such as bans on some products, taking foods out of public schools, those kinds of questions about those programs and the trade-offs that they involve. So what we'll think a lot about those issues. July 12th, tobacco. Tobacco is this interesting story, as I glossed before, this really one with a particularly important trajectory across the last 100 years in American society, and one that continues to be fought in the courts most recently with respect to the questions about the advertising, the public health messages that the government wants to put on package labels of cigarettes, which is currently being held up in court and at least has been enjoined, at least for now, from doing as a matter of free speech. And these are legal questions, and I'll talk a little bit about this intersection of ethics and law and how we'll handle it in a minute. But questions about efforts to dissuade the American public from smoking, from taxes, from bans, from the signs we see, this question, the spectrum of questions about tobacco and its use in a country such as ours, we'll think about on the 12th. Last few weeks, as we work our way down the home stretch, environmental and occupational health. Lots of interesting questions about the health of workers, about the health of communities with respect to industry and things around them. We'll cover in that week everything from the aftermath of the Chernobyl explosion in the 80s and what it meant for the communities most directly affected it with respect to their health and how they identified. Adriana Petrina's work, who's here at Penn in anthropology, which is one of these masterworks of this field. Two questions about occupational hazards that in some sense have been historical phenomenon but continue to have consequences for retirees, people who have worked around asbestos and their consequences, and these questions about health, environmental hazards, both indirect and direct or deliberate and accidental, and what that means. And we'll even talk a little bit about BPA in that last reading there, the plastic chemical. So we'll talk about those questions and what they mean for health and how intervention should be shaped to mitigate them. Last 2 weeks, we'll then really back out to questions of politics and policy. That July week, those of you who took Zeke's healthcare policy course, hopefully a nice complement to, with not a whole lot of repetition. Our focus that week will be not on the shape and design and nitty-gritty of healthcare reform policies or programs or the technical questions, but really a step back of thinking about what do ethics and values contribute to discussions about how healthcare ought to be designed and delivered. So some reflections on that, thinking about social justice perspective, thinking about how communitarian ethos might be part of a discourse about what we owe each other as citizens in a community in a shared country for contributing to access to health and high quality, affordable health care for all. So this will be it'll be more conceptual than practical in that sense. Then the last week will be our sadly one explicitly international focused question on public health ethics and global health. And it will talk about a couple things. One, the practical ways in which, as Tom Friedman tells us, the world is flat, but in practical terms, the way in which decisions that are made by the U.S., in the U.S., by other wealthy countries have direct, real, significant implications for the health of populations around the world. So there's the very technical reason why these things matter in an interconnectedness, but also these questions about what do we owe when we think about communities, what do we owe our global neighbors, and is it different, or ought it to be different from what we owe people who are our countrymen or our residents of the same community or same city, and this question about how we sort out those obligations with respect to health interventions, both in a financial sense and in larger ways, why that matters. So that'll be our last class meeting, which will bring us to this group presentation thing, which I'm particularly excited about on the last week, which will let us back up, we'll get there again, and then talk about assignments. So there's a couple components that will be central to your direct contributions beyond participating in the discussions throughout the semester. And three of them. One is your attendance and informed participation. As I said here, I hope the readings will not be terribly onerous because they are critical. As I say, 80 to 120 is probably the range. When it's on the higher end, it's usually because it's heavier on social science in the more historian sense. Book excerpts. So all these books that I talk about, I've picked a chapter or two that I think capture the essence that would be wonderful if you have more time and interest to dig into. But when they're on the longer side, they tend to be very easy to read, very engaging narrative by scholars who are not, you know, writing philosophical proofs for 120 pages. You don't need to worry about that. These are readings that I think are all designed to be thoughtful, substantial, but hopefully not burdensome, given that you all have many other obligations in your life, and I try to narrow them down to just those things that would be the most valuable to getting us where we need to get. So that's sort of the baseline point there. Then, throughout the semester, and we won't schedule these until next week in case there's any fluctuations, and this won't apply for next week, I'll happily lead the discussion. Starting in week three through the rest of the semester, each week, three or four of you will do a nice, very fair and equitable draft lottery, ping pong balls and bingo hoppers and all next week to figure out who does what. But each week, three or four of you, depending on how many of you there are and how they work out, will serve, and I say lead discussant, but that sounds really far too fancy for what I have in mind here. What that will be the people who will together jumpstart our conversation, who will, among the three or four of them, this is an individual project, but not a project, an individual activity, but among the three or four of you, you'll decide who wants to cover which of the four, five, six, seven readings. Usually there's some logical divisions there, and each of you, of the three or four of you, will offer, generally early in the class, a short, informal, God no slides, we don't need a script, but a 5 to 7, I think I say no more than 10, but even that is too much, introduction to whichever of the readings of that week you and your colleagues have divided. Saying a little bit about, and we'll talk more about this next week, but helping us set the stage for what reading X is trying to argue, what the key points are, what's really relevant there, what might be controversial, what might be worth discussion or debate, what's the real claim, how does it fit in with other things we're thinking about. It's along those lines of really helping us get through what can be that awkward, how do we get rolling kind of challenge in discussions, especially with a larger group such as this. So we'll assign, we'll give you your choices and some sort of preference order next week, so you'll know, and I don't think you need more than a week for this, so even the folks who volunteer or end up by default having to do week three, this wouldn't be something you'd want to have, you'd need more than a week for, that together you will share with us some points that we ought to mull over in our time together based on your view of it. So it's a minimal effort kind of thing, but it helps me then know that there are also three or four people who I know have really actually thought seriously and substantively, and I'll trust that the rest of you have as well, and we'll see that as we go along to help us develop our discussions. So that's the lead discussant role. Not a lot, you'll do it once in the semester, but what's also important about that is 2 weeks after whatever week it is that you are the one of the lead discussants, that's when you'll give me the short, again, short is the name of the game here, essay, even calling it a paper is probably elevating it too much, a short paper, I think I say no more than six, but probably 4 to 6, some shows up there somewhere in the text, that will be an essay that is inspired by the topic for which you were the lead discussant 2 weeks earlier. So you have some time to think about the discussion that happened. And what that's going to be is a case analysis. You're going to pick something that we talk about, whether it's the guy in San Francisco, if you had the TB week, the guy in San Francisco who was subject to the court order, whether it's a soda tax that was proposed in Philadelphia a year ago, whether it's a proposal in the state of Vermont that would ban religious exemptions from vaccine mandates. It will vary based on the week that you're working with and whatever interests you. And it can be any type of case, but I want it to be something real. I don't want it to be a, you know, rumination on the powers of the state in a liberal society in 4 to 6 pages. I want a discussion that is inspired by the course, by the week and the readings from the course, where you have, as I talk about in the little paragraph there, pick a case that's interesting and discuss it. Discuss what's at stake there, why it matters, and how you think, in some thoughtfully argued way, it ought to be resolved. How do we move forward in a way that I think is sensitive to ethical concerns and also achieves the public health objectives that their sponsors think about. So plenty of time to think about that. No one will have a paper due until a month from today, and we'll have time to talk about it. But the idea is you'll have a week that you are particularly engaged in. You'll help us get the conversation started, and 2 weeks later, you'll give us a written reflection, you'll give me a written reflection, I should say, of some particular aspect of that topic that appeals to you. And those are, again, individual projects. There just happen to be three or four of you who will have the same week and can divide up the introduce the paper section among yourselves, but the papers will be individual. So those are that's the only thing that's going to be formally done by you before that last week of the semester, and that this is this thing that I'm maybe more excited about than I should be, but hopefully I'll convince you that you should be too. The challenge for a course like this is, what is the final assignment? There's sort of three options. The first two I think are pretty lousy, especially in a summer course, and the challenges that schedules create for us all. One would be that everyone does, you know, a 15 to 20 page paper. Well, okay, it's kind of an easy default topic to assign, but I think it's hard for it's probably hard for me to give 30 of you the kinds of feedback about, is this a good topic, here's what you want to talk about, here's an interesting idea, here's a piece that you really need to think about. And it's hard, I think, for you, given other demands on your time, the week-to-week demands, to actually produce by August 9th a good paper. So we're not going to do that individual 15-page paper thing. The second thing is the final exam model, which some of my colleagues here do, and that works too, but again, this course is less about me imparting a body of knowledge on you that I will then test. You know, how many states have soda taxes in 1997, and you know, what are the arguments for and against it? Those things serve a purpose, but not the purpose that I hope to attain by the end of the summer. So the idea I came up with is to allow us, we're starting with these sort of big conceptual questions about, you know, what does ethics have to contribute to public health. We're then going to spend most of the semester in the weeds of specific topics, specific cases that are relevant to sort of understanding the breadth of the field. what the final presentations, which will be a group project that will involve presentations here in the last class session as well as a written document that will follow it, will be a chance to then take a step back and think about what we will increasingly find throughout the semester is that there are a lot of unresolved but vitally important questions about ethics and public health, about questions that transcend any given issue, from soda taxes to vaccines to tobacco regulation to alcohol advertising, whatever, but that there are big fundamental questions for which clarity on them would inform many, many specific in the weeds type of cases. So what we will do, and we have weeks and months to sort all this out, so please don't worry about it now. We will come up with some democratic way for individuals to organize themselves into groups, some sort of either it's preferences, or if people have no preference, we'll work that out. Groups of five of you will be responsible for putting together what you see as effectively a research proposal for the kind of conceptual issue with very practical application and practical policy relevance in public health, for which a group like the President's Bioethics Commission, who does this, they don't do it for a living, they do it for free, but does this as part of their job, would be well served, that there would be benefit in an extended look at that sort of issue. So you're not answering a question, but you're saying, and I give some examples here, about the kinds of questions that might be important. Understanding and evaluating risk. Oh my God, every single thing we talk about will be related to that. That you will present a proposal orally in that last class session and then in writing a few days thereafter that will introduce why that topic's important, what its relevance is, what's been said about it, what's helpful, what's unresolved, and why a group like the Bioethics Commission that is tasked with looking at big, unwieldy issues. Right now they're looking at genetics and privacy, for example. Why that kind of high-level, very public review would be a valuable thing to have. That's the scope of it. This is good for a couple reasons. One, I know some of you have unavoidable life conflicts that will keep you away from us on those last few weeks of the semester. That's okay, because this will be a project that will be a team effort that will involve many things, and the actual in-class presentation need not be five people, you know, tagging in for three-minute intervals in the last week of the semester. So this will be a project that will involve background research, it will involve writing. I'm all for democracy. When groups are aligned in June and July, you will divide up, you will agree on a topic, which I will sign off on just so there's no duplication, and then how you divide up the effort to get us the final product, the presentation in class, and the paper a few days thereafter will be up to you. So that hopefully will resolve some schedule conflicts. And I will ask, as journals do these days, how the work was divided up. I'll ask each of you to help me understand how you contributed to the overall effort, whether it was preparing the script for the talk, whether it was helping identify the topic, whether it was drafting the report. We'll talk all about this a lot in great time as the semester goes on, and kinds of issues will clarify themselves. So don't worry about it for now. The one thing that's exciting is I wrote on the syllabus that it was a mock thing. Well, it may be less of a mock thing than I may have thought when I wrote this a couple weeks ago. A fellow MBE alum and a former colleague of mine on the Bioethics Commission staff, Kate Spector Baghdadi, also a JD MBE from Penn, is now the associate director of the commission staff. So she's one of the 15 or so full-time folks in Washington. And it sounds like she will come up and spend that class with us. The commission has a full plate for the next year or two, but these are things that they are always interested in, interesting new topics, and I think she'll she's eager to hear, and I'm sure that it will be well worth her time, to hear the kinds of ideas that might be the kinds of things the commission would be well served to think about. So that is likely going to happen, and certainly things we can talk about down the road. You know, these are the kinds of things we could happily send the papers that will follow the presentations. We could send them to Dr. Gutman with a nice cover letter, because she loves Penn synergy. This is great, you know, Penn Bioethics Commission, Bioethics, Penn, Amy Gutman, kinds of things that she would eat up. So we can think about ways in which this will serve our purposes to really try and put a bow on this eclectic set of issues, but also recognize that, you know, we can contribute as citizens in a democratic society and a group that's engaged with trying to promote education on these topics. So much, much more to say about that. But basically, you'll lead a discussion, kick off a discussion, you'll give me a short paper a few weeks later, and then we'll have this final project, which I think can be done with minimal time outside of the regular class hours. The Bioethics Commission itself can write these massive reports with just a couple face-to-face meetings and lots of emails and track changes. So we'll try to reserve some time at the ends of classes that if you do need some face-to-face time, but I recognize you come from many cities and you have other jobs, and this will be framed in such a way that this won't, you know, you won't have to spend long nights and weekends in each other's company unless you want to, and that's none of my business, to get this project done. So that is, my God, it's an hour of just housekeeping stuff. Questions, preface with, please don't worry about too much of this right now, but other questions about the shape of the course, where we're going, how we're going to do it. Is that a hand?
No.
No. Any questions along those lines? Good. All right. So what else did I want to say as far as that? So a couple things, you know, it's hard. Public health ethics is often linked together with public health law. Many of the readers, there's a course in the MPH program that's public health law, ethics, and policy. I'm going to try my hardest, which is good because I'm not qualified to talk about public health law, because I will try very hard not to get us down that wormhole of case law, legal decisions. Those of you who have that background, I think, will be important. We're going to be interested in legal mechanisms, whether it's state vaccination requirements, whether it's taxes, whether it's penalties, whether it's, you know, police powers. We'll certainly talk about those as ways to implement decisions made by policymakers about implementing the conclusions of ethical analyses about the obligations of the individual to a state. But we're not going to read case decision. I'm not qualified to give you that, and I want to be sure that in thinking about the ought questions, the normative questions about how, what's at stake in these topics, I don't want us to get bogged down in legal decisions and precedents and things like that. So we will certainly recognize that legal mechanisms are hugely relevant to public health policy, but it's not a course in public health law. It's also not a course in practical policy, practical professional ethics for the public health field. You know, we are scratching the surface of the activities of the vast, complicated public health establishment, and many of the things that, that public health workers on the ground do every day, frankly, involve none of these big sort of macro questions about regulations and policies. So this isn't a course in that either, and I apologize. And the third thing, there are hugely significant conceptual questions here that are under that heading of political theory or political philosophy. This is the stuff about the just society and about communitarian beliefs that we will, again, hint at here, but many of these, this is sort of the sampler platter at TGI Fridays, where you're going to get, you know, four buffalo wings and three mozzarella sticks, but not the full order of all of them. So we will, I love TGI Fridays, I'm sorry. So I'm like 6 years old when it comes to that. So these are things that we will touch on, but recognizing that there's vast areas for further exploration. And if we have accomplished anything by the end of the summer, it's to point out how much important stuff there is to think about. All right, so transitioning to substance. The question that we'll be thinking about throughout the summer, starting right now, is what relevance does bioethics have for public health? And vice versa, what relevance does public health have for bioethics? It's a question that, if you looked at the paper by Ron Bayer and Amy Fairchild, motivates their paper. It's the question of, well, their answer is a simple one, saying, yeah, it really doesn't. That the things are so different, that they come from different places, that they're built around different beliefs, that thinking about the ethics of public health through the lens of the bioethics, as all of us to some extent, some more than others, but all of us to some degree have encountered, if not in the classroom, in the media, in attention to medical controversies. So throughout the semester, we're going to be trying to figure out what can bioethics add? Why should we, as people who have some demonstrated interest in bioethics, what can we bring, what should we bring to public health, and what can the policies and practices of public health in the United States and around the world contribute to bioethics? So I noted that bioethics emerged, and the articles here certainly confirm that, bioethics emerged from a very different place that helps explain why issues in public health have not been dominant in conferences, in journals, in academic departments like ours, until very recently, and even still, in fairness, there's only a handful of places that really are doing the premier work in ethics and public health, and you're going to see the repetition of those scholars. There's a very important program at Columbia in the Mailman School of Public Health, which has the folks like Colgrove and Rosner are from that center, and Fairchild and Bayer are from that center, and we'll read from others from those as well, who have really, they've been at the forefront for a few decades, really probably founded the subfield, or whatever it is, of public health ethics. A second group is down at Johns Hopkins in the Bloomberg School of Public Health, and that's folks who, again, we saw on the papers for this week, Nancy Cass and Ruth Faden and Jeremy Sugarman and others down there. So it's a very small field. Bioethics is small to begin with, but the individuals who have really said, let's put our lens on public health as a specific entity and figure out what's unique and important there is even smaller. So the repetition is not just because these are dear friends of mine, but because the people who have been driving the ship have also sort of, in some sense, been the few passengers on the ship. And hopefully one of the things we can do is try to build out the knowledge base of individuals who say, now this is important not just for the ethics of public health, but is important to integrate with larger studies in bioethics. So, how many people took Art's History of Bioethics course this past spring, this semester? Was it a year ago now?
No, this recent
semester. It was just this recent semester. So this will be familiar, at least to a few of us. Bioethics emerged, will you tell me, Nick? When we think about the modern era of bioethics, when was the, give me a ballpark date.
I guess you could maybe peg it with the Hastings Center.
So 1960s?
Late 60s, I guess, maybe a little bit before that.
Yeah, some people push it earlier, some people point to the Nuremberg trials. You can go back a little to the late 40s. There's a debate, but it's certainly a middle of the 20th century phenomenon. And it emerged out of, what were some of the, that's why you never raise your hand. No, please raise your hand.
Well, I guess it started with really a substantial focus, I guess, on theology and philosophy. Mm-hmm. A lot of the early people were kind of theologians in the Catholic tradition was, I think, pretty common.
Yep.
And a lot of philosophers as well, and then it kind of slowly segued and I guess maybe merged in metaphysics later on.
Mm-hmm. That's an important distinction too, is that it's getting even harder to find the distinction between bioethics and medical ethics. Our name is changing gradually from the Center for Bioethics to the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy. Medical ethics has a far, far longer history, right? Medical ethics goes back, we can go back to Hippocrates, we can go back very, very early to that, but even the American Medical Association Code of Medical Ethics, we're back in the 19th century, there were texts even in the very, very early bridge between the 18th and 19th century. So medical ethics in the sense of what the physician owes or is responsible to his patient in that very narrow individual clinical care setting has a long history, but it was a practical knowledge, principles, and tenets of the what we would now call the physician-patient relationship. Bioethics, it's a discourse, and as a set of ideas and a set of scholars, is a much more, let's say, under 50-year-old field that emerged from theologians, philosophers who are interested in the life sciences, but are also interested in key controversies that were brewing up in the air in the 1950s and 60s. And those questions were the kinds of questions that continue to get most of the attention in bioethics, even to this day, despite some changes. These are questions about the design and conduct of human experimentation. So they're the research ethics questions that are a huge part of contemporary bioethics, were a huge part in these early days of bioethics. And people sort of reconstruct the history, thinking about the Nuremberg stuff, thinking about Henry Beecher's famous paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1966, pointing out highly regarded research studies where there were ethically dubious activities going on. The Tuskegee syphilis experiments we'll talk about in a couple weeks came to light in 1971-72, at least came to light nationally. They had been an open secret within the government for decades. So that one thread that really was a significant part of the early days of bioethics and remains so are questions of human experimentation, human subjects research. Other questions had to do with, again, another huge topic, which is continues to be controversial and provocative, questions about the beginning and end of life. So questions about the abortion discourse, about questions about end-of-life treatments and withdrawing and removing care. Some of the terms have evolved over time, but those fundamental questions about life and its limits on the margins also were things that were really dominant if you look at the journals and the conferences in the early days of bioethics. And from those topics and others, but I think those topics, I'm comfortable to say, were among the stars, the bioethics language became one that was informed largely but not exclusively, about the rights of the individual patient or the rights of the individual research subject and the obligations or responsibilities of the physician or researcher. So it's this question about the patient-doctor relationship, the researcher-subject relationship. And this is where bioethics, the primacy of autonomy in contemporary bioethics, which continues to this day, became sort of the dominant, as Bayer and Fairchild note and others would agree, that bioethics emerged largely about a question about autonomy and its limits. When do patient preferences win the day? When are patient preferences overridden by some other factor? The autonomy of research subjects to provide voluntary consent as an absolute requirement as a participation in human subject research. So the bioethics, from its earliest days, emerged around the notion of autonomy in response, in part, to the frequent, prevalent attention to practices that we now, and at the time, would be defined as paternalistic. These are the stories you hear about from the 60s of, you know, the doctor who would only tell the husband that his wife had cancer, or the doctor who would only, you know, who would lie about the patient's diagnosis because they figured it wouldn't be good for them to know. Those kinds of things, which now clinical ethics, we have the research ethics and the clinical ethics, this idea that paternalism in medical care was a terrible, horrible thing that needed to be avoided by empowering patients, by informing patients, by making patients informed, engaged partners, which I think is another course, but I think is by and large a very good thing. The complications, as all these things have, but that movement was an important one, one that I think is one of bioethics' great achievements in the last 50 years. So in a field that was about the individual and questions that were framed as matters of autonomy, it becomes clear why public health doesn't fit well into that kind of discourse, into that kind of scholarly framework. Because in public health, we are not talking primarily about the individual. Individuals are important, clearly, and that's going to be a recurring theme here, but we are talking about thinking in terms of populations and communities, whether they're in towns, whether they're in cities, whether they're in nations, or whether they're globally. So this question about focusing on the individual doctor-patient encounter, the individual research subject discussion, is a tough fit when we shift our focus to public health, which we should define, by the way, because public health has many definitions, but we should start at least on the same page. Someone give me, from what you've read or your life experience, what's a good definition for public health? Because it's an important concept, because this is a question of what the limits are, as the title of the book says. You know, where public health begins and medicine and health policy ends is a tricky question. So how about any shot at definition of public health? Please.
I would say, in general, it's sort of broad policies implemented to ensure the health of the entire population, and that's abstracted from not just an individual standpoint, okay, for the entire broad population.
Okay. People want to add, supplement, offer alternatives? Please.
Utilitarian perspective, most health that you can have for the most people with the least amount of risk to others.
Okay, interesting. And these are each piece of that We could debate how to get there, but thinking about maximizing health, minimizing risk, that those questions are trade-offs. The classic is hidden, kind of hidden, in the cover of your book. It's in that this text here that's sort of embedded in here. And it's, if you can read it or you haven't seen it, it says, public health is what we do, is what we as a society do to collectively assure conditions in which people can be healthy. And this, and it showed up, I think, in several of these papers, this is the one that often tends to be footnote one when someone's writing a paper about public health. And it's a definition that came out of an IOM report from the 1980s that I think is safe to say is very popular. The public health folks in the room can tell me otherwise, but from what I've heard, it's usually thought of with great pride among practitioners of public health, and I think it captures, in a general sense, without offering judgments of how we get there or how we prioritize things, but what we do as a society to collectively assure conditions in which people can be healthy. So again, that emphasis on we as a society, who's a society, that's a question, what we do collectively, and conditions in which people can be healthy also extends that definition beyond things that might feel medical, like vaccinations or epidemic investigations, to even including broader questions of public health, like the socioeconomic status and living conditions and things that we know through lots of data are important parts of individual health, if not directly, then indirectly. That's one definition. A couple other ones that showed up. The Childress paper talks about public health aiming to understand and ameliorate the causes of disease and disability in a population. That's a good one. There's no right answer there, but I think they all help us sort of picture the different flavors. The Nancy Cass paper says public health is a societal approach to protecting and promoting health. Okay, so you get the idea there. So we're thinking about communities, we're thinking about societies or populations. So whereas bioethics has been shaped by many principles, many of you are familiar with the Belmont principles or the Beecham and Childress principles of autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice, I'd still argue, and I think others would agree, that those principles all matter, but autonomy tends to be the first among equals, that we're thinking about, you know, when is autonomy trumped by another consideration, and that in traditional models of bioethics, justice plays a limited role. When we think about justice in bioethics, we might talk about, you know, rationing dialysis machines, or we might talk about making sure that we're not abusing one population as subjects of research. But justice tends to be a member of the horn section in the back of the band playing the second fiddle. That's a terrible mixed metaphor of music, fiddles, and horns, or whatever. But autonomy tends to be the dominant guide in bioethics discussion. It's flipped in public health ethics, as we hear, and we will continue to hear, that bioethics, public health ethics is thinking about social justice, is thinking about equitable distribution of health in all its forms, in terms of access to health, in terms of resources, in terms of attention, that we are thinking about trying to not privilege one member, one population, one subset of a community through health interventions, but thinking about programs that will ideally raise the health status of all, even, often at great complexity. So that's this question there, where public health ethics is shaped by social justice concerns, it might be shaped by communitarian concerns, but the idea of individual autonomy sometimes can be a tough fit for public health ethics. Now that's not to say, and this is the challenge that I think makes these topics so incredibly interesting, whether it's vaccination or others, is that we are constantly wrestling with trade-offs between the individual and the community in almost all the topics we'll be thinking about throughout the semester. And let me come back to my vaccine example, that we can have a very straightforward, if we're thinking about mandating a vaccine, we'll talk about much more detail in a month or so, we can have a very, you know, straightforward, and advocates, my friend Paul Offit is vocal on this side, a very straightforward utilitarian type argument for why it's a good thing to mandate vaccines, right? We know that people who aren't vaccinated not only put themselves at increased risk of vaccine-preventable disease, which to some advocates of public health, that enough would be justification to mandate vaccines. We'll get there in a while. But others say, okay, but they also place those around them at greater risk of vaccine-preventable disease. Therefore, you know, their preferences aside, public health dictates, ought to dictate, that they receive a vaccine. So we can parse that out as we get there. So that's that population community focus thing. And how can we maximize, I think it's a fair and important argument, how can we maximize the prevention of vaccine preventable diseases? Well, other issues aside, getting everyone vaccinated is the way to go. The challenge for interventions like that, in many of the examples we talk about, is that the decision to have a vaccine happens in the context, in most cases, in the context of a clinical encounter. It's happening largely in a doctor's office or a medical clinic or some point where it is a medical intervention, where all those things we otherwise care about consent, about communication between the physician and the patient or the physician and the patient's family, that all of those things don't go out the window, or maybe some people think they should, but they're certainly there. So many of these issues in public health are encounters that involve individuals, individual decision-making, individual medical interventions with unique and important community consequences in ways that, frankly, many things in medicine don't have, right? The decision for me not to take a statin for high blood pressure, which I don't have yet, thankfully, despite my TGI Fridays diet, the decision for me not to take a statin has few direct benefits or direct risks to others. You could argue about, you know, future children or healthcare costs. We can go down those lines, but they're more tenuous than a decision like a vaccine or other types of examples. We'll talk about secondhand smoke and tobacco, these kinds of cases that are important. So that's where these public health issues, that clearly the focus shifts from just the individual, which makes it complicated, but this question about communities is important. And the second thing, which takes some getting used to if you've spent a lot of time in bioethics circle, is that paternalism is not a dirty word in the ethics of public health. As you hear, some of the people we've seen in this week's readings and we will continue to see are unabashed supporters of paternalism, that believe that the state should require motorcycle helmets, not because of some grand argument, but because it's the right thing to do, and if you're too stupid, they would write more eloquently than I'll say, but that's basically what the arguments are in the literature, that if you're too stupid to realize that it's a good bet to wear a motorcycle helmet, then the government has a responsibility to its citizens to help you make that decision through the force of law. So paternalism, and Ron Bayer in a couple weeks, 6 weeks or so, I think we'll come up with that as an analog to, I think, the obesity. So another sort of idea of this question of soft paternalism versus hard paternalism. This is this whole Cass Sunstein nudge idea about how do we urge people, how do we create circumstances where people will make the right decision through policies or programs, or in which cases do we just say, no, this is what you have to do, or you'll be fine. Seatbelt laws, for example, are another example there where people argue it's the right thing to do, there's great consequences, there's great benefits, minimal risks, the state believes that's where the point of intervention should happen. So paternalism is not a dirty word. This is a safe place to talk about paternalism in ways that it wouldn't be elsewhere in bioethics. But you can see why those frameworks, those ideas, are unique and are uncommon and are hard to fit into other issues in bioethics. And that's what we'll spend a great deal of time thinking about. Questions, comments, reactions so far? Feel free. Please. Jeff.
This is really tangential, but I kind of feel like we're talking about physics here with quantum Newtonian. It's like on the macro and the micro levels, you're looking at a whole different ballgame. I don't know. It's weird because it's like, how do you square, if it's all ethics theoretically, mm-hmm. how do you say, well, if we're looking at this level, these things matter, and this level, the opposite things matter, and they're like, really, in very similar ways in direct conflict.
Right. Now, are they? And that's the question that I wanted to... And this, it's a great segue, because that's the question that we have to figure out next, is should we do what several of the authors, especially the Nancy Cass paper and the Childers-Faden, Professor Moreno and others' paper says, and they say, you know, we can start with bioethics. We can recognize the fact that these things seem in conflict, that they seem messy, they seem incomplete, but if you look at some of the ideas, the relevant ethical considerations that this paper, and again, we're going to come back to all of these ideas and flesh them out through examples throughout the semester, so if you feel overwhelmed, please don't. But if you have the Childers et al. Paper there on 171, they talk about relevant moral considerations for public health. And if you look at them, they sound a lot like the kinds of things that any ethical analysis in bioethics, regardless of the topic, would care about, right? So I'll read them. It's relevant medical, general moral considerations. Producing benefits. All right, that sounds beneficence-like. Mm-hmm. Avoiding, preventing, and removing harms. Well, that's certainly not maleficence. Then there's this utility thing, which certainly is an important part of many ethical theories. Distributing benefits and burdens fairly. Well, there's justice. I think we have an autonomy here. Respecting autonomous choices and actions. So these very distinguished folks say, you know what, we can work with bioethics. We can understand the fact that our weightings, our analyses might come out in a different place because of the fact that the aims are different, or the focus, the lens is broader, but that we can work with bioethics. We can work with these ideas and just try and shape it. Bayer and Fairchild say something completely different. They're saying that bioethics is too autonomy obsessed, and trying to talk about these issues through the lexicon of bioethics so as to say that, well, autonomy is still good, but maybe in this case we can override it for public health purposes. They argue that it's too messy, that it's too separate, there is no grand unifying theory, to take your physics metaphor, that maybe we shouldn't try, maybe these things shouldn't interact with one another. So I'm curious, based on your own readings of this, that where do we go? Should we try and think of this as something new and different and try and match it up, or should we recognize that there's a salvageability when we shift our focus from individual medical care to public health stuff? Is it a start anew or work with what we've got? Trina?
Well, it just sounds like we might need to define a group autonomy. What is group autonomy? Mm-hmm. Rather than just individual autonomy.
Yeah.
Because I think beneficence and non-maleficence, that's covered because we're looking at what is best for group. But I see it, that seems to be a sticking point of autonomy. So how do we define that term?
Yes. You want to answer how we define that term? Because that'd be impressive. No, we'll save you. We'll let y'all talk for now. Please.
Well, this the same paper kind of discusses weight and strength versus range and scope. Mm-hmm. You say you have the same principles, but when it's the choice of one, that the weight that you give to autonomy should be more significant. And when you're talking about larger group, then the weight of justice should be more significant. And then every time you reassess the scale.
Mm-hmm. So a question of emphasis, which in bioethics we're familiar with, right? We know from the bioethical principles that they don't help us figure out what the right answer is. They help us identify relevant considerations, and then the weighing, that's where it gets messy, and that's where critiques of bioethics come in, figuring out, all right, what do you do once you've identified the issues and figure out which one should win the day? Please.
This is maybe sort of along the same lines, but is there really a reason that autonomy wins? When you were just talking sort of briefly about the history of bioethics, it kind of seems to me that maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of seems to me that autonomy was at the top because of, in reaction to the bad things that were going on, that you know, whether it's the research stuff or, like you talked about, doctors being really paternalistic or whatever. And I kind of wonder if those weren't the problems that bioethics came about in reaction to. It was a horrible sentence, but you know what I mean? would something other than autonomy be most important? I mean, is there an objective reason? Has anyone said, like, here's the reason that we want autonomy to be most important?
Jeff?
Well, can I follow? Yeah, I mean, and I think you actually make a really good point there, because it's sort of like you're saying, we needed autonomy to get us this far, and maybe once we're comfortable with the level of autonomy that we've really worked into the system, now we can start taking other factors more seriously.
It seems like a reasonable argument, yeah.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I think just going back to what you guys were saying, if you think about it sort of deontologically and you look at an individual patient-physician relationship, you kind of have two competing principles. You have the principle to easily prevent premature death when you can, mm-hmm. and the principle to allow individual people the right to choose for themselves. And I think you can really talk about those same two obligations on a broader scale of public health. It's just that, like John was saying, maybe the implications of each of them are different. Mm-hmm. So the implications of, you know, individual choice, you know, choosing that over easily preventing death is much more grave when you're talking about an entire population.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is another reason why I think there's a convergence happening, not just from the the disease prevention and the cost thing, but these other questions about trying to understand the consequences of individual care decisions on the overall healthcare system or the overall community. And that takes many forms. That takes the antibiotic resistance argument there, because the question comes up in that case, well, we can talk about being good stewards of healthcare resources on the one hand, or being sensitive to the community consequences of indiscriminate use of antibiotics in a much more on the ground sense. But individual physicians say, you know, how is that going to shape if I'm, you know, in a doctor's office with patient X, how am I going to decide, you know, not to use a borderline intervention that I think might serve a benefit, but because on balance, the economic modeling data shows that that's actually not a good bet for all patients. This shows up with the mammogram screenings, which we could have easily talked about. The mammogram policies, the PSA policies just came out this week. This question where people are putting the lens of community consequences on individual decisions and arguing that those individual patient-doctor decision-making actually, on balance, isn't as good a bet as it's thought to be, or in the case of antibiotics, have actual, real, harmful public health consequences. So that's another area where these things are merging together. You wanted to chime in.
Sure.
Please.
I can wait.
No, please.
I was going to say, I think about it a lot more, in many ways, pragmatically as well, and I can probably resonate with a lot of the nurses in the room, and in what I do, in the ICU, you're oftentimes dealing with this real kind of, unfortunately, disconnect between this idea of autonomy, which is supposed to be in the ICU setting, the ability for you to say, I don't want therapy, but what in reality oftentimes becomes the demands for therapy, mm-hmm. versus paternalism, which wasn't all bad, actually, back in the day. Paternalism is what drove physicians to save a patient who came into the hospital by giving them blood transfusions, sure. until patients started saying, wait, I don't want a blood transfusion. And in the early cases that many people here may know about, with withdrawal and withholding of life-sustaining therapy, it was the physicians advocating leaving the endotracheal tube in the airway and breathing for the patient while the family was saying, please take it out, she's dead, you know? So there's this sort of tug of war between those two. And I think that somebody was talking, I think you were talking about, like, where, how did autonomy become so prevalent, so important in the hierarchy? And we deal all the time with this issue of where we really would like a little bit more paternalism. And there's even literature to support that, of families having greater degrees of PTSD and anxiety when they're involved in the decision-making that occurs in the ICU. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, to stem that tide of autonomy, sort of the pendulum that has swung so far on the individual patient level, is very hard to do, because there's social norms now and ethical norms now that inform what we do. And you can't simply say, well, for this patient I'm going to do this, and for that one I'm going to do that. To have public health policy, which is really, I think, the other side of the same coin, mm-hmm. really two different sides of the same coin, be able to create practical guidelines in ways for some things, for us to do things, allows the physician on the individual level to say, this is what we do as a society, and this is what sort of we as a group, sort of in a communitarian way, have decided, as opposed to trying to do it on a one-on-one basis.
Mm-hmm. So we have these twin challenges for the design of public health programs, particularly those that subset, those that restrict liberty in some way, that might either restrict, violate individual privacy or notions thereof, that might limit individual choice, that there's that twin challenge of this context that has emerged, and we can argue normatively whether it's a good or bad thing. I think it's still on balance. It's a good thing, this idea of patients as leading decision-makers, informed decision-makings in their care. So we have that medical context that predisposes against interference in matters of health by other individuals, explicitly against patient preferences in some cases. And then, of course, we can't ignore this larger political context of rampant distrust in government, distrust in decision-making, distrust in authority, that is certainly this libertarian ethos in the United States in particular, that's an important part there that leads to skepticism and resistance when public health programs are rolled out, particularly those, and this is going to be an important thing that several of our authors talked about this week and will come back throughout, particularly when programs may not be sufficiently explained, supported, promoted so as to build understanding and support among the public. I think I'm particularly interested in these process questions, because when we talk about group autonomy, well, who's the group and how do they decide? These questions about who has a seat at the table, literally or figuratively, and for those folks who don't have a seat at the table, how are decisions about programs, decisions about trade-offs, about figuring out how to maximize benefits, minimize risk, decisions about what's in the best interest of the health of the community, how are those communicated, justified, in the phrasing of the multi-author paper, so as to allay skepticism, to build support, to make it such that the compulsive hand of the state, and we'll talk about examples where public health authorities and public health powers are very significant with good reason when need be. The limits on public health powers in a full-fledged crisis can be few, from closing schools, from involuntary confinement. These are these extreme scenarios. But clearly, I think there's a wide consensus that those sorts of powers that openly, blatantly, severely restrict or limit individual freedom, individual choice, need to be used sparingly. That generally, a far better strategy to succeed throughout these questions are ways to change habits through education, through promotion, through information, or through a less coercive, let alone less compulsive type of design. So these questions about where on the spectrum from information to education to the soft paternalism to the we're going to tie you down to the table and inject you with the vaccine in the arm, which in some doomsday, you know, sci-fi movie scenarios, you could make a case for when that might be warranted. But clearly, despite what critics of vaccines or the public health departments think, is not an appropriate intervention in all but the rarest of circumstances. So to figure out where on that spectrum of engagement, education, and compulsion programs ought to be centered is a deliberative process that matters. And you have a hand?
Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, we're talking about autonomy. I don't know if autonomy is the right term, but kind of on the opposite side of the group. If you look at like healthcare worker vaccination, mm-hmm. you know, like, well, you have the autonomy of the healthcare worker to get vaccinated, but then you have, you know, the autonomy of the patients, the people coming in, to not be exposed to other things that they're not necessarily going to the hospital for, going to the doctor's office for. So thinking about it both with the individual and then the group side.
Yes, so who, which individuals? Because, right, there's not always a individual versus community. It's one class of individuals versus another that further adds complication. So, oh, please.
One of the things I'm struck by is, what's the consideration that health is so unique that it commands a sort of justice? And it seems one of the competing principles are whether or not health, the conditions for proper health, whether or not that's a necessary condition for a just society, or whether or not a just society provides for the optimal health, or whatever the conditions in which people can be healthy. Mm-hmm. And it seems like this is a competing notion when we're talking, like, why are we talking about autonomy and justice with health?
It's interesting. Any quick reactions to that? I'll take a stab at it. So this question about, and this is where the discourse about health and ethics and health has butted up against human rights language, because that's the question there, is, you know, this notion which is contested in the United States, but about whether there is an absolute right to health, is whether the ideas about questions of human rights, about the kinds of things that are the fundamental basis on which individuals ought to be enabled to live, whether health is part of that language. Now, I think the advocates of public health, and we're going to read most, you know, these are people here that we'll be reading and thinking about, and I suspect most of us in the room feel the same way too, that health is a good thing. But it's important to question this idea of what is or should these kinds of questions about health be privileged in ways that other areas of life that have also significant impacts on the quality of one's existence, whether it's education, whether it's, we could go on from socioeconomic status or standard of living or these other questions, which correlate with health and are interrelated, but is health or should health be privileged or special? I don't have an answer to that, but I think it's something we want to keep thinking about as we go forward.
Dream. There seems to be a unification of suffering. When public health policy was originally being brought into society in the 1900s, there was a lot of, it was basically focused on disparities and inequalities. And it seems as though when you're suffering, when there's a suffering, it's easier to define the group economy because you can make a decision that's going to help alleviate whatever is going on in society. But as things get better, people move more towards individuality. So how is that? This is like with the vaccines and people moving away from vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
How do we keep that collective memory of when everyone is suffering and dying from vaccinations so that people understand that there should be a sort of a mandate that everyone should be vaccinated because of the kind of health consequences. So I guess I'm just trying to think of how group autonomy can be used and translate into public health.
Absolutely. Another thing to keep in mind, please.
Actually, I was thinking that in the early 1900s, it was more focused on like pandemics. And, you know, the laws or whatever that moved public health forward were based upon things that they knew were going to affect populations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in saying that, looking at, you know, thinking about disparities, I think it's a different type of how we perceive it over time, what those criterion are, how we frame it based upon, you know, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, things change.
Yep.
And, you know, as ethicist, or as I hope to be an ethicist,
mm-hmm.
How we can help frame or structure that argument in moving us in a positive direction.
Yep.
So that's how
I think that's right. I mean, the traditional narrative, and again, the public health folks who've done history can chime in, the traditional narrative of the last 150 years of public health is a period marked by the development of the germ theory in that 1880s to 1900 range. It took some time to disseminate and gain in popularity, but that idea of a germ-based focusing on individual transmission, focusing on controlling, responding to outbreaks, which tied in with questions about sanitation and hygiene and clear water, that infectious disease prevention and response was happening in the end of the 19th century. Right around the same time, it's important to note that while there's a long history of attempts to protect public health, the idea of a standing public health department itself was a mid-19th century creation. That often there was a terrible outbreak of cholera in 1832 in New York City, and they'd marshal resources, they'd figure out how to quell it. People would get the situation would improve, and then the group would disband, and they'd wait 20 years for the next outbreak. So the idea of thinking in terms of germs, of course, took a while to get beyond the idea of vague miasmas and people who were immigrants and were therefore sick and these other unhelpful accounts of unhelpful, is that a politically correct way to describe it, horribly inaccurate and inappropriate kinds of questions about disease transmission, to think about both the idea of individual transmission of disease and also public health as an ongoing responsibility of the state is not, in the United States for example, is not a something that goes back to the founding of the Republic. They were putting out fires for the first century and a half of the nation. And only then did communities, Massachusetts, Milwaukee, which had a socialist government into the early 20th century, and were not surprisingly leaders in sanitation and clean water and clean milk and all these important public health programs that continue to this day, those came up in fits and starts into the 20th century. Then the story goes, this idea, the famous, infamous quote, that, around the 1950s, that the era of the infectious disease, I'm paraphrasing, is over, and then the shift in resources and attention to chronic disease questions, cardiovascular symptoms and their effects and those things, which really was a challenge for the public health departments, which continues. So this question of priorities and waiting has been ebbs and flows along the way. Please.
I would say that you're talking about this shift between, infectious diseases and, chronic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's almost a shift now, at least in pediatrics, to now, psychological diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And, so now we're dealing with autism and ADHD, and we don't have a very good body of evidence for people to draw on to make their own decisions, whether it be, the public or even healthcare providers to some degree. We don't know why they happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying like suffering, how, you know, builds, you know, there's unity in suffering, and I feel like that with the unity in suffering that they've attacked, that's their autonomy. So it's like an uneducated autonomy, kind of, but you know, they're like, maybe not uneducated is the word, but it's interesting where public health fits and all that. So now with the psychological diseases, for lack of a better word, behavioral, like, so how does public health fit in?
Sure, and the role of disease definitions matters significantly, and you know, we can encourage growth in resources for prevention, for treatment, but ultimately we're dealing with a resource-limited pot. As much as we want it to get bigger, at some point it is finite, and figuring out where attention goes is absolutely a question of ethics and values and public health, to figure out where the most good can be done as far as research towards preventions, towards treatments, towards interventions. Autism is one of those examples where autism versus anything else, or even autism etiologies, figuring out, you know, there's those squabbles within the autism community to figure out where the most good can be done and trying to understand the causes and treatments of it. So I think that's absolutely germane to things we'll be thinking about. Please.
Kind of to just going back to what you said before about what's necessarily right with autonomy, I might be one of those libertarianist skeptics who say in a country where self-determination is our principal value, I think there's a risk. We already relinquish so much of our lives and our health and everything to government intrusion. And it's easy to sit here and have this discussion when we could say, well, paternalism isn't that bad. Yeah, in some cases, when you're on the right side of history.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've been fortunate in our generation in terms of ebbs and flows where we don't have a leprosy thing where persons are forced to go to Louisiana and lose their whole lives and their freedom. We don't have that kind of thing. AIDS, HIV could have potentially brought back some of those questions, but I think on some level, if you're going to relinquish that power to decide, when does that stop? And not to be too alarmist, but I think that is a concern that a lot of people do keep in the back of their mind.
I think it definitely could be a slippery slope. But I can't help but think every time I'm treating a patient that it is because self-determination is so paramount in the United States, I feel like, and maybe I'm just biased, this is my opinion, so if people disagree, that's totally cool, but I feel like people are so consumed with what's right for themselves that we, this is unique to the United States, it's not like this in Europe and other countries, we don't spend a lot of time talking about what's best for everybody. And we use a lot of resources, we allocate a lot of resources in medicine, specifically in taking care of patients, especially end of life. 25% of all healthcare dollars are spent in the last year of life, and those are dollars that could be, and I'm not saying I agree with it, these are dollars that could be spent taking care of people who might have a more quote-unquote meaningful life. I'm throwing around a lot of terms that can be, you know, that can engender a lot of discussion, but I just think that there's a lack of awareness of what might benefit more people.
Quick rebuttal, if you don't mind. I mean, there's something inherently vulnerable, though, about deciding for others and losing that choice. And I think there's great merit to what you're saying. I agree with portions of it. I'm just a little bit concerned when you talk about either group decision-making and on a moral framework where we're going, I'd rather have an individual be wrong than be wrong for the whole. And that's just the way that I look at it. And I think on a moral level, I'd rather see someone make a choice that I don't personally agree with, but they felt was right for them, even if I think they're wrong.
Sure, and there's tons of examples in history of where you talk about group morality and choosing what's best for everybody, and there's how many of those people were on the wrong end of that, not because they just were the losing side in terms of the decision, but because they were disenfranchised and never had a voice in the first place, right? And certainly what gives one individual sort of the moral authority to decide for another individual about certain values and expectations. So it's a tough balance.
Did they chime in? Please, and then we'll come back around.
I guess I was thinking in terms of, are we as a society more receptive to public health measures when we feel individual risk?
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that in vaccine issues, and clearly in pediatrics. If measles comes into my community, are my patients more receptive to being vaccinated when they had concerns about it before? Mm-hmm. So it gets into both the sense of community and a sense of autonomy and how they mesh together, but they may be affected by a sense of immediate risk.
Yes, notions and perceptions of risk, whether real, confirmed, accurate, inaccurate, I think will be another unifying thread throughout all these cases about who feels at risk, who is judged to be at risk, and how those risks can be addressed or identified or mitigated, I think is another one of these questions here that is very relevant.
And, I was thinking in terms of when you said suffering, I pulled that in too, because we can empathetically suffer if we see someone in our community directly affected, and we may not feel that when it's a more distant.
Yeah, so these notions of solidarity. This is what the last week when we talk about Peter Singer's piece, which I know many of you have read in Autumn's classes along the way, this notion is it any different? Is if it's suffering that's immediate to us or suffering that we know is happening but we don't see, and how that affects our perceptions and how it affects our obligations is relevant even in the U.S. context too, when we know of consequences of choices. Please.
I guess I was thinking more towards the group and when you're in dire straits, and actually when you were talking about it too, whether it's really that people are more perceptive or whether you're giving up your autonomy and actually asking someone to come in and help you when things sort of calm down and maybe you have an opportunity to think about it more. Then the idea is, I think, that we have to think about whether we're educating people to actually make decisions when you have more time. You know, are we being lazy at some level? Lazy is not a good word. But the idea is we have to think about that, because I think there are a lot of examples in which you're looking at policies, and if the people who are doing the policies actually spend the time to actually educate people, then they can actually make what would be the paternalistic decision that you would make, mm-hmm. but by giving them the autonomy to do that. And I think that there are situations when you can't do that. And you probably have run into people where people are stressed and maybe can't actually be quite as rational. But I think from a general perspective, you need to keep that in mind. You need to keep in mind that often a population, when they still get to retain autonomy, if you educate them properly, can actually make that decision that you would make for them.
Please.
To touch upon that.
Yeah, that happens.
Hopefully that doesn't diminish my point. When you look at the consideration of self-determination, the problem that I have with that is that it kind of has this reflective naturalizing of disease or whatnot, and saying that people who do have disease, there's an onus on them to be making these decisions of self-determination for their own health outcomes. What I think it ignores or perhaps misses is when you see what the biggest co-indicators of what health outcomes are. Poverty are the highest things where you see where it takes place. So we might not be sending people down to Louisiana for leprosy, but you do have endemic poverty, which is probably the number one indicator of what the health outcomes are. And so when you say it's self-determination, I think one of the big things I'm looking to see are, do they have the capabilities to be making self-determined decisions? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Sure. I mean, just my quick reaction to that is I always hesitate in thinking about groups and in terms of that, or if we're going to just analyze poverty or lower socioeconomic classes. I hesitate to say that we know best. I know it sounds weird, because as a group of educated, ethical thinking minded people, it sometimes feels like in this room we do know best. And I still think as a moral framework, it sometimes is okay to let people be wrong. And I don't know if that's going to resonate in here. I might sound ridiculous to some, but I think on some level, knowing that someone has the choice to be wrong is important and should be respected. But that's just my take on it. I don't have to be right. I mean, that's...
You have a hand up?
I was
going to
kind of build off your point. I think equal to poverty is also education in terms of like deciding health outcomes. So people who are less educated tend to be also. So, like, do they even have the ability to make the right decision? So are they wrong because they were never given the chance to be right, or are they wrong for another reason? So you have to, like, look at all those factors.
Please.
Yeah, I think the complicated thing about medicine, and I say this as someone who's been working to learn, like, to study medicine for the past several years, is that it's complicated, and even for highly educated people, it's difficult to understand. And I think as much as, like, clinicians attempt to explain it and make it accessible to the community, I think there are some people who it's not always within their grasp to understand everything. And so the challenge is, like,
exactly what you're saying, like, do we, like, can, is it, you know, can, do we allow people to make poor decisions if they're not going to be capable of making good decisions? And I think sort of like the others, I know it sounds like horribly paternalistic, and I think the more time that I've spent in a clinical scenario, the more I've swung towards sometimes feeling more paternalistic, because you do become frustrated when you see scenarios like that where you feel like, you know, gosh, this isn't the right thing. It's not the right allocation of resources. And then just the one other thing that I would say is that autonomy isn't always, it's not like it's universally good for the individual and bad for the community. Sometimes autonomy is also bad for the individual. Like, you know, people come into the emergency department, for example, I've seen this a number of times, like demanding that their child gets a CT scan. And it's not indicated, and it's not totally benign, right? Because it's a lot of radiation exposure for a little kid. And in that case, like, autonomy is actually bad for the community because it's expensive, but it's also bad for the individual because it's not the right thing for the child.
I'm just going to add on to what Katie said, which is, I don't know if I coined this term. I hope I can publish it and coin it, or somebody else has already done it, but it's what I actually call the perversion of autonomy in medicine, which is people thinking that the right to come in and demand a CT scan is exercising their autonomy. I'm sure I didn't make that up. No, that's what I did. But
somebody Google it.
In this classroom, I made it up. And so I'm that's the issue, right? Is we're talking about a kind of a perversion of autonomy. I want dialysis for my father because XYZ, and I'm not going to get into the details of how the paternalism versus autonomy kind of concepts go back and forth between the two, but I do agree a lot with what you're saying, and that the biggest challenges I've had in medicine for me in talking about these issues are not the ones where the person says, I hear what you're saying, I understand what you're saying, and I'm choosing this anyway. I mean, it's not unlike being a parent. For those of us who are parents in the room, you allow your child autonomy, even if they make the wrong decision, because that's how you learn in a lot of ways, and that's okay. It's the ones where I don't think they actually can make an informed choice, right? Part of autonomy is having informed consent, is understanding the risks and benefits before you do something. And I don't even understand if they have an awareness of informed choice, and yet I'm going to give them the autonomy then to make what I think is the wrong choice. It's hard.
I think, though, one thing I just want to point out is I think it's important to differentiate between individual patients and you know, group stuff, public health stuff. Because I think, like, the two big differences are first of all, in the individual situation, you have a patient that's come to you and said, you know, I'm sick and I would like you to help me. And so I think that maybe gives you some leeway to say, well, this is what I think is right for you to do, as opposed to, you know, the government going out and saying everybody has to go out of the way and do this thing that you may or may not want to do. I mean, the relationship is different. And secondly, you know, when we talk about whether people are educated enough to make their own choices, yeah, I'm sure most people are not educated enough to know what to do in the ICU, whereas if we say to people, if you smoke, you will die. It's not that complicated. You know, I mean, so I think they're very different situations, and I don't know that we can necessarily compare the two.
But I think something that's lacking in this debate that we're having right now, actually, is thinking about the ways that, like, your actions actually impact other people's and what their role in public health is there. Because, for example, you know, people love to talk about the motorcycle helmet and you know, the mandate that motorcyclists wear helmets. But, like, not only is that a important measure for those people, but actually, like, we're all tied into this health system together. We're all paying for it. So it's like, at what point do we insist that people have to wear helmets? Because if they get in an accident, like, all of us are going to pay for it. Or if, you know, in terms of, like, smoking, you can make the argument that, you know, you shouldn't smoke indoors because all the secondhand smoke is a really negative effect and, like, a negative externality on all of us. So that's kind of, like, an interesting...
Yes. Yeah, and you made a really nice point about that, right? That sometimes you have to let people make that decision for themselves, even if it's the wrong one. And what I was going to... the way I was going to challenge you was just
right,
that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, give me one example of when you think... in a vacuum, you can allow someone to make the wrong decision, quote-unquote wrong decision, and somebody in this room is going to be able to find a way to tie it into the public health, to the community. You know?
Yeah,
and they're always intertwined.
And we're going to have to, you know, it's a certainly very common and important argument to figure out is this healthcare costs, you know, we all pay in the end, I think is an absolutely frequently voiced justification for public health programs. We're going to have to think about throughout the course of the semester whether it's sufficient, whether there are limits. The slippery slope question comes to mind, particularly in that case, in a way that maybe secondhand smoke, I say secondhand smoke doesn't, perhaps because it's more direct. You can follow the pathway. Well, I'm going to tie things up here for now for several reasons. One, because it's almost 6:30. Two, because what we've accomplished today is exactly what I wanted to, and we will continue this kind of discussion next week by adding some more voices, some more ideas into our sets of thoughts to sort of percolate. And this level, I mean, admittedly, our discussion right now is at high level and abstract, and that's okay, because what we want to try and do is figure out, get out on the table what's at stake, the concepts, the ideas I was jotting down as we were talking, questions about suffering and trust and self-determination and decision-making and the balance between autonomy and paternalism. These are the terms of the debate that we want to think about, both in theory and then increasingly in practice as we move throughout the semester. So, you know, if you would like me, like grounded things based in specific evidenced examples with facts and context, hang tight, because we'll get there, and these kinds of questions that we're mulling over right now will continue to come by. The last thing that I think, regardless of whether we think this is a bad thing or not, I think we've pretty conclusively, by the comments around the table, noted that, like it or not, the concepts and tenets of medicine, and then therefore by bioethics, are part of the ethos, part of the public consciousness, part of the ways in which questions about public health policies and their propriety and their merits will be understood and perceived by the public, given historical context, given the far more frequent and visible encounters individual patients have with healthcare providers in the medical setting rather than sometimes more nebulous public health setting. So that I'd argue, and I think it sounds like there's consensus around the room, that like it or not, we have to think about bioethics and its ideas and the questions of autonomy as a driving concept as relevant one way or another to the ways in which public health programs are designed, promoted, shaped, and ultimately implemented. So this was a wonderful start. Thank you for your participation. We keep it like this. It will be a fun summer, and we will pick up all these things next week. Thank you.